Mammoth
Audio. This is Scamapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not leave a review on iTunes? If I enjoy it, you'll have made me very, very happy. And if I don't like it, well, then I'll ring you up in the middle of the night and I'll leave you a review, and then you'll see what it's like when people judge your work all the time. Not so tough now, are you, big guy? Sorry, I got carried away there. Look, we all know there's probably no such thing as the paranormal. There's no ghosts haunting your toilet. There's no creatures under the bed. That fortune teller at the local market is at best deluded and at worst a con artist. But what if just one of them was real? Wouldn't you want to know about it? Since the Scientific American magazine first threw down the gauntlet to the world spiritualists in 1922, there have been paranormal challenges, groups of skeptics and rationalists keen to cast the bright light of science onto unbelievable claims, and offering cash prizes to anyone who can prove those claims are true. Richard Saunders has not only been involved with the world-famous Randi Educational Foundation Million Dollar Challenge, he's also helped run the Australian Skeptics $100,000 Challenge and acted as a judge on the less-than-scientific reality TV show The One. On today's episode of Scamapalooza, Richard explores the difficulties in testing psychic powers and what happens when the scientific and the spiritual go head-to-head. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scamapalooza. I looked at your Wikipedia page for the first time and I discovered two things which I already knew, which you are a skeptic and a podcaster, but also you are a professional origamist. That you're not, because I've seen on Facebook and social media, you like delightful origami and assumed that was maybe a hobby or something, but that's, you've done that professionally and on television.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not like I made huge amounts of money out of it, but I have written...
you made your real money in the podcasting field. That's where the big bucks are.
Oh, right. Sure. I've written many books on origami, but they were many years ago I did that. I also, about 6 years ago or so with a friend, we did a DVD on how to do lots of origami models. So from that point of view, yeah, and I've invented many models myself. The most famous one that I'm known for is the flying pig, Pigasus, which I'm very proud of. And that's on YouTube too. If you'd look up origami Pigasus, like Pegasus, and you'll find the instructions, me sitting there saying, hello, here's how we fold an origami pig. And a lot of people get a lot of enjoyment out of that. So that's quite pleasing.
And according to Wikipedia, I didn't know this, that you actually taught me origami in the late 80s on the Australian television show Wombat. I remember learning origami.
That's incredible. That was a very, very early appearance, one of my very early TV appearances. I remember the day very well. They came to my house at the time, and we sat out on a little balcony there, and I was making all sorts of things for the TV show. It was a lot of fun, and I still do it. I still do it. In fact, I have my own line of origami jewelry, which I'm very proud of, and it's a great thing. I'm really pleased that when I was a small boy that I learned how to do it.
And since then, you've made a lot more television appearances, more in your role as a skeptic, and one of, if not the leading skeptic in Australia. I can't think of anyone who gets out and fights for reason more than you do, except for myself, of course.
Of course, yeah.
Today, Tonight, Sunrise, all the classic, all the talkback radio and the ABC, and perhaps most famously, you were the resident skeptic judge on The One, which was Australia's. I describe it as Australian Idol for wannabe psychics. Is that a correct assumption of what the show was?
Something like that. It's hard to describe it. I think it was broadly put under the label of reality, which is a bit funny when you think about it. It was just an idea that, in fact, he's deceased now, that Simon Turnbull, who was the president of the Australian Psychic Association, actually put the original idea to Channel 7. It was basically a way for them to plug their own psychics, because don't forget, it's a huge industry, the psychic industry, and they make a lot of money on the Ring Up a Psychic line. They're very popular. And I think Simon was looking for a way to basically plug his people, get more notoriety, But the show needed a skeptic. And I'd been on TV with Simon before, on Sunrise or something. And we got on all right. You know, I wasn't on there telling he would say he was foolish and being arrogant and stupid about it. I was trying to just be pleasant and have a good time. So Channel 7 approached me to be part of the show, and after much negotiation, I did it. The first series was in 2008, I think, and the second series was 2011. And I don't know if there'll be another series. I have no idea. It's just up to the whim of the TV executives. But it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of frustration, but it was a lot of fun.
So because you have someone who already clearly believes not only in the existence of psychic powers, but their own psychic powers as one of the – was he a producer or in any way involved in the making of the show?
Yeah, the first series he was there quite a lot. Basically he was – now what was his position? Something like confident and the aid and the help of the contestants. He was there to make sure that they were all happy. He wasn't really in any sense a producer of the show. There was other people, professional producers, running the show. He wasn't around in the second series. In the second series, they had another person who claimed to be a psychic from, in fact, one of the contestants from the first series who was there to help the contestants and ease their worries and that sort of thing.
So with those sort of people involved from the very beginning, and with the fact that it is a reality TV show, as far as tests of psychic ability and looking for proof of the existence of those sort of paranormal skills, a show like The One doesn't rank very highly as far as scientific rigor then?
No, not at all. But it was never meant to. It was first and foremost a TV show to get people to watch. Then we sort of take it from there. Now, on both series of the show, I was a consultant for the tests. As I said to the producers quite early on, you can't just give me a fait accompli and say, explain that, skeptic. I could probably rip it to shreds because, you know, people, the general public, TV producers included, don't know how to run a proper scientific test. But I offered my advice and I wrote the protocols for tests, knowing full well that there would just be one run once off, so in that sense it wasn't very rigorous. But I didn't want to make it so that no one would ever pass a test completely, otherwise there would be no show. So I just had to make it like a fun, interesting sort of experiment. Will they do well on this or not? Let's have a look, and then I can comment on it later on in the show.
And as a judge, watching the show, I assumed that in knowing you and your background and also knowing the format of reality TV, talent shows, for want of a better word, that you, I assumed, would be filling the role of the main judge, that your job would be to tell them, what are you doing with your life? Like, shoot them down in flames. Tell them that they're either delusional or criminal and send them packing with your extraordinarily scientific abilities. But you were not just even-handed, you were very friendly and very supportive of the contestants on the show. Was that a deliberate decision that you made?
Well, they said they wanted me to be me, so I was just me. But you make an interesting point, because if I was another person they invited on with similar knowledge of how the psychic industry works, and they were mean and ripped people to shreds, there would be a big discussion backstage, and they would probably say, well, thank you for being part of our show. I think we'll look for somebody else. That's not what they were after. They didn't want someone to come on there and be mean and rotten, or indeed belittle the contestants, otherwise people wouldn't watch. It was as simple as that. And it's interesting that you have the opinion that I was pleasant and even-handed and not rotten, because if you speak to many believers who watch the show, they will tell you that I was rotten, mean, arrogant, and all the rest of it, because that's what they perceive a skeptic should be.
More of a cynic.
Yeah. And so I got emails and Twitters and comments along that line, saying that I was like that. Someone wrote to me and said, "Is that the judge you play on The One? Is that the real? Is that you? Or are you so arrogant? You know, why are you so arrogant?" Stuff like that.
Science is why I'm arrogant.
Science.
That is, though, I guess, a characteristic I've noticed of people, the people that I see as being rationalists or as being skeptics tend to be people who come across as abrasive and come across as sometimes arrogant, but certainly, you know, curmudgeonly in the case of, say, James Randi has that.
Human nature.
Yeah, so, human nature. Whereas the people who are the most successful psychics always come across as very nurturing and caring. I think that in a television or in a sort of media context, that seems to be the way in which they come across to me. But I assume you've crossed swords with some awful people from the
psychic world. Well, to be blunt, yes, I have. I mean, this is an interesting point because I've had discussions with some of these people who come across all lovely and new age and you know, full of wonderful emotions and stuff. And if your conversation with them starts to stray into you doubting their abilities and pointing things out, then they go very quick colors. Which is arrogant, rude, mean, belittling. A lot of them are like little children, and they'll throw tantrums, and then they'll pull the "you're a mean bully" card. "You're a mean bully. You're a skeptic. How dare you say these things about me? Look at this man, everybody. He's harassing me," and on it goes. It's interesting. A lot of them are very incredibly insecure and ready for a fight. It's amazing. But yes, of course, a lot of them come across as lovely and sweet and light. But you start to question their abilities, not in a mean way, not in a bad way, not saying, "Look, you're an idiot for believing this," but saying, "Well, let's have a look at what you're claiming to be able to do." It doesn't take very long at all before they get their backs up and conversations usually end.
I'm reminded of there's a video in which Mark Tilbrook, I think it was outside of a Sally Morgan. It's a British
medium. Oh, yes.
And he got harassed by her family.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
There's been various, you know, lawsuits and all sorts of people being very upset with him. And that was in a context where they didn't know they were being filmed. So it seems like the job of psychic and medium is, and again, we're talking the high profile people, but it is very much a publicity game just as much as it is paranormal demonstration or you know, psychological connection. It's very much about how you present yourself to the
general public. We can't tar everybody with the same brush. Everybody's different.
Yeah.
But a lot of these people, the very high profile ones, it's their living, it's their family's living, it's their existence, it's what they do. And on one level, you have to think, well, whatever they're doing, if they're a candlestick maker or a butcher or a baker and somebody comes along and tries to threaten their livelihood, there's going to be a lot of anger there. Now, these people happen to be doing something that we think is, in some cases, dodgy. But regardless, you know, that's what they're doing and that's their livelihood. So if someone comes along and looks like upsetting that apple cart, the natural thing to do is defend it, whether it's right or wrong. So you've got to look at things from so many angles in this job. It's interesting.
So the one then is an example of a test in inverted commas of psychic abilities that as we said doesn't hold up to scientific rigor. That was about making great television, entertaining
That's
television,
right.
and
That's
not
right.
about proving whether psychic abilities exist or don't exist.
Not really. I mean, but it did give me the chance to point a lot of things out to the audience, which I was quite and to the TV audience, of course, which I was very pleased to do. A lot of what I said didn't make it to air, but that's normal in television. I'm well aware of that happens. A lot of what my co-judge Stacey DeMarco, a lot of what she said didn't make it to air. It would, you know, we were cut, but it was mostly fun, and it also gave me the opportunity of when I was walking down the street, people would recognize me and come up and ask me things, and that was pretty cool.
So it's definitely a great way to connect with people. Then
it is. It's got its good points and its bad points, but I think overall the good points outweigh the bad points. It certainly helped get a lot of people introduced to skepticism, which I'm quite pleased about.
So let's look then at some of the more rigorous tests of paranormal ability, because this is, for people who don't know, something that has been going on for the last 100 years or so, is the idea that a prize is offered by an individual or an organization if evidence can be provided of paranormal abilities. And it's sort of the idea is it's this public challenge where people can take part, who claim they have paranormal abilities, can take part and in a controlled environment prove that they have skills. And if they succeed, they're given $1 million, $100,000, you know, yeah, some sort of prize. And there's a lot of them. You've been involved in the Australian Skeptics have a prize of $100,000. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
And then of course the famous one is the James Randi Educational Foundation's $1 million challenge, which is yet to be claimed either. But going all the way back, the first one I could find was the Scientific American test from the 1920s that Harry Houdini was involved in. We talked about it on another episode briefly. Is that the first one that you know of?
Yes, it probably is, because I know Houdini was very into this, because he came from a point of view of desperately wanting to contact his mother.
Yeah.
Who, after she died, he missed his mother terribly. And so he went around trying to find the one mystic or the one clairvoyant via seances and things who could do this for him. And with his incredible knowledge of illusion and conjuring and magic tricks and deception, he was bitterly disappointed to find again and again and again that these people were using tricks that he knew. We now in this day and age was ready to accept positive proof. A lot of people are under the impression that we are out to debunk and show people up to be frauds. There's no doubt about it, there are frauds out there, and if we can debunk, well that's fine. We can point out where something is not right. But we're also, and one of the reasons for the money on offer, we're also on the lookout for positive proof that these things are real, and science will be challenged to have a look at these things. That's pretty exciting. You know, that would be mind-blowing if one of these claims happened to be true, and the scientific method demands that we keep an open mind to that. Not so open our brains fall out, as we like to say. It doesn't mean that if we hear a very unlikely claim, we think it might be true, let's investigate it. You know, it would be disingenuous to say we take that attitude. But we do have an open mind, which is what science is all about. And if somebody can do what they claim they can do and win the money, they win the money. There's just no two ways about it. They win the money.
One of the criticisms that is leveled against these types of tests is that, and obviously every test has its own rules, but the idea of essentially proving something that is paranormal, in inverted commas, means proving something that defies the laws of science, that defies the laws of the universe as we know and understand them. But as soon as you prove one of those things to exist, or one of those things to be real, you are then redefining the laws of the universe. So if it's sort of proving ghosts exist, it's sort of like once you've proven ghosts exist, you sort of you've proven that they are something that is a part of the natural law, and we need mm-hmm. to redefine the rules by which we're playing.
That's right.
And therefore, you don't need to give the prize because that thing is no longer paranormal. It becomes normal.
We would give the prize. Yeah. The agreement is written up before we start. And this is another thing that people don't understand, is before we test anybody, whatever their claim is, we spend a lot of time to come to an agreement about what we're going to test, under what conditions, what they expect the outcome to be. On it goes. It's a legal document. It's like a contract. And if in the case, as you suggest, somebody says they can speak to ghosts, and we agree that is the claim, and they speak to ghosts, we hand over the check, then we rewrite the rules of science. They win. They still win. It doesn't matter. And then we all benefit, because suddenly we have proof of something incredible and new, and science goes into a giddy frenzy.
How then do you decide what is a paranormal claim and what is just an extraordinary claim? Because I know there was talk, and this is going back several years, of speaker cables. So there's $3,000 or $4,000 speaker cables that connect from your stereo to your speakers that are supposedly, you know, provide the best sound you possibly can. And there was a suggestion that that's impossible, that there is a, you know, there's only a certain amount of quality you can get from a speaker cable, and the idea of charging, making extraordinary claims about speaker cables borders on paranormal, and they could in fact claim the $1 million price. And I believe, and again, I'm going from a five-year-old, you know, memory, but that James Randi had things to say, like, and it may have just been hyperbole, but that was, you know, that was within the... I just did a quick... Google.
I can save the effort, because last year in Las Vegas, this is exactly what we tested on live on stage at the Amazing Meeting. Although, what I will say about that is, while it was an interesting claim, you're right, it sort of was on the border of what we should be testing and looking at. We did a test with some cables. The test we ran indicated that they were no better than other cables, but I will say it was a stage test. It was more for entertainment and more for crowd interest than a really rigorous test. There's only so much rigor you can put into a live test on a stage during a convention. But yes, that's one of the claims where it's, well, will we do it or will we not? If we do it, we might be able to make a point. But we can still doubt that super expensive cables and cheap cables can carry digital information, ones and zeros, differently. But yeah, that's one of the ones where we'd have to think about it and say, well, will we test this or will we not? But personally, I much prefer the good old stuff, the good old paranormal stuff.
I always call it Ripley's Believe It or Not Science, that kind of the stuff that ends up in all of the books. I'm sure you were like me, one of those kids that pored over all of those books of ghost sightings and Loch Ness Monster UFOs.
I have many of them in my cupboard, right, in my bookcase right now. Oh, yeah.
You know, part of the reason I became a critical thinker, or someone who's a lot more skeptical, is because when I was a kid, I read one of those books, and it was presented as sort of historical. So people used to believe this and used to believe that. And the book was written in the 70s. And when it came to the present day, it started talking as if the stuff in the present day was true. And so I believed for a good 5 or 10 years that if you meditate under a pyramid or put a banana under a pyramid, that it had some sort of special abilities that would keep the banana fresh and keep it calm. And I totally believed it. I mean, it wasn't that I gave it any sort of thought, but I just had no reason to doubt it because it was in such a beautiful book with lovely thick stock.
Yeah, now that's an interesting case, because pyramid power is one of the rare times where a new age idea has fallen out of fashion. It doesn't happen often. Usually people will cling to things for a long time, you know, whatever they might be. But I think pyramid power fell out of fashion because people had to do work to actually construct pyramids and little, you know, wireframes, or buy them, or whatever the case may be. But yes, I certainly remember hearing about that. If you put a razor under one of these pyramids, it doesn't go blunt and fruit doesn't rot or anything like this. Well, simple testing showed that was all just marketing.
Yeah.
People were selling pyramids for some reason, or making money saying they're a pyramid power guru, or writing books about it.
Yeah. So that would be something that could claim the $1 million.
Oh, absolutely, and very simple to test. Yeah, yeah. Two pyramids, put, or three or four for control reasons, put a bit of fruit under each one and carry on from there. Yeah, no one has ever come to us, actually, with that claim for the $1 million. I think most people have forgotten about it.
All right, I'm gonna put in my claim for the
$1 million.
The first modern, I guess, modern is, you know, relative term, but after the Scientific American, because that was very much focused on ghosts and mediums and that whole spiritualist movement.
Talking to the dead,
But the first one to offer a real sort of substantial prize and to I guess set the groundwork for what we know today as the skeptical challenges, that's the Abraham Kuvors challenge, which was back in the 60s, I think, and that goes back before Randi and the other ones, who listed out a whole bunch of miracles that he would pay, I think it was like 100,000 rupees, which was the Sri Lankan rupees, if people could prove that they existed. And rather than doing what you said, which was to sort of say, you know, come to me with your claim and we'll nut out the details, he listed 20 or 30 different things that he would very clear things that he said, look, if you, you know, these are things everyone, this is the top list. These are the hottest paranormal skills in Sri Lanka today. If you can prove any of these actually work, I'll hand over the cash. And he went to his, you know, he went to his grave without anyone ever coming close to winning those. But some of those, I don't know. I mean, some of those, I've got the list here. They're quite specific. And they read, to be honest, like a magic show. Like it's read the serial number of a sealed up currency note. That is a magic trick.
It's a classic magic trick.
Yeah. Materialize from nothing an object I ask, which is, you know, again, magic. Walk on water. That's stealing other people's material. get out of a locked room by spiritual power. Produce a spiritual. Yeah. And it's very much things that have, in that 50 years since he started that challenge, become stage magic tricks.
A lot of them are, and it's an interesting way to go about it. Of course, as I said, in the modern times, what I'm involved with is asking people or inviting them to tell us what they do, what their claim is, and then we'll work from there. We not so much what this guy was doing and saying, this is the claim, I want somebody to do it. It's an interesting take.
Do you often find it difficult to nail down exactly what someone is claiming is their ability? Because I've noticed that a lot of the time people's paranormal claims require a sort of series of further explanations of new beliefs and new ideas that themselves kind of end up, you know, like a snake eating its own tail. Like, for example, someone saying, you know, that this is someone is... you know, I'm going to claim I'm going to exorcise this demon from this person. And it's like, well... okay, but first of all, you need to prove that the demon exists. And then they say, well, no, but the demon is from the Bible. Okay, well, they have to prove that the Bible, what's in the Bible is true. And their claims become more and more vague and more ethereal. And they start, of course, making up their own terminology and language that is very difficult for a layperson to comprehend, let alone prove or disprove. Is that something that you come across?
Yeah, we do. Now there are... many people who come to us with their claims. We have, it's on our website at skeptics.com.au. You can read all about the $100,000 challenge, but there are three basic questions we want people to answer before we can proceed with anything, because we have to know some basic stuff. The first one is, what exactly is your claim? You know, precisely without three... written pages of small type, succinctly, what is your claim? Number two, under what conditions can you perform your claim? So we know. I mean, it's no good testing somebody on Monday if they say they can only do their claim on Tuesday or something like that. And number three, what percentage of success do you normally expect with your claim? Is it right 50% of the time? Is it right 90%, 100% of the time? Answer those three questions, you know, in very straightforward manner, and we'll work from there. A lot of people we get can't answer the first question, or they'll descend into rambling and double talk and confusion, and ultimately we just can't proceed. So yes, we do get some, and some people, I must say, we do get are sort of in a troubled mental state, if I can put it that way, and sincerely think that there's all sorts of extraordinary things going on in their lives. And some people we recommend that they seek, you know, better help than we can provide.
I'm sure that goes down very well. They come to you with their claims of godlike powers, and you tell them they should go and seek a
But you can tell by their speech and the way they ramble and so, all walks of life, there are some people who are troubled. We know that. And sometimes these people come to us with their extraordinary claims, or they think something's happening, or they think that the aliens are watching them, and so on. But generally speaking, a lot of people can't answer the first question properly without descending into double talk and argument. But sometimes people can answer them. Water diviners are people we've tested more than anybody. And normally what they say is they can find hidden underground water. They can do it any time of the day or night, and they have 100% accuracy. So that's pretty easy to start with.
Now, that water divining is an interesting one because, like you said, one, it is easy to prove or disprove, but secondly, it's one that feels the closest to reality, closest to reality as we know it. I do high school shows, and I sometimes demonstrate water divining for the students, and I do it successfully. Or I get a student to find water. I upturn 10 upturned cups, and they've got to figure out which has got water under it. And they always succeed. And then I point out there's water under most of the cups because there's water under most of the Earth's surface. And they never sort of cotton onto that. They always present quite reasonable and logical reasons for why water divining might work. Whereas when you talk about ghosts or psychic powers, they kind of roll their eyes and treat you like you're crazy. Whereas water divining feels the idea of like, well, yeah, if you've got the right equipment and you wave it over the earth and, you know, yeah, I mean, the body's 70% water, so maybe there's like a current or magnetism or something. It feels real. You witness it, when you watch that scene from The Water Diviner with Russell Crowe and he waves his sticks and digs and finds water, and there's his well, and he gives his cheer to the heavens for his success. It all feels extraordinarily real and rational. Is that something that you as a skeptic need to and trying to test those abilities? Is that something that's difficult to overcome? The internal logic and the reasonableness of some of these claims.
Well, water divining is a really good case because we have, as I've said, we've tested over the years hundreds of water diviners. I've been involved with big water divining tests myself. And I do what you do. I go to schools and I do a water divining demonstration. And a lot of people assume it's real. It's just part of what country folk do, and some people have this special power. But it's an interesting case in point because there is nothing you can do to get a water diviner to think that their powers might be a delusion. It's really interesting. It's a steadfast, immovable belief in them. It's not because of society saying this is a real thing, although that has something to do with it. It's because the rods move in their hands and they don't know why they're moving their hands, so they assume it's some mystical or unknown power to science that's moving the rods. Whereas we know it's just they're subconsciously tilting their hands. It's as simple as that. But you can't talk people out of that. That belief is absolutely firm. Again, a lot of people, it's their life. It's their living. It's what they're known for. They use confirmation bias and all sorts of things to believe why it works so well for them. They usually say it works 100% of the time. That's how convinced they are it works. But in all the tests that we've done, they all fall back to random chance.
Just on water divining quickly, what was your reaction when the new head of the CSIRO a couple of years ago, Larry Marshall, basically said that we should do more work trying to uncover why water divining works and basically gave it a scientific thumbs up as the head of one of Australia's peak scientific bodies. What was your reaction as someone who's spent their life coming across, you know, water diviner, I was going to say fake, but, you know, water diviner after water diviner who just cannot do it. What was your reaction when that happened?
You mean after I picked myself off for falling off my chair?
Yeah.
We were dismayed, actually. We were surprised. We were disappointed. We awarded him the bent spoon, which we do annually. We give this prize to the most preposterous piece of paranormal or pseudoscientific piffle.
And the bent spoon is like the exact opposite of one of these skeptic awards.
Yeah.
In that,
yeah,
you can't choose to get it, and no. It is thrust upon you unwillingly.
It's thrust upon you. Yeah, and it was very disappointing, and we made it clear that we found this disappointing for somebody who should know better before he says something like that. It was outrageous, and it's still outrageous, and I'm still gobsmacked.
And did he respond? I mean, did he, Did anything
he didn't,
come up?
No, he didn't respond. A lot of people never respond when we award the Ben Spoon. Some people do. But to think that one taxpayer dollar would be spent on a wild goose chase like that is pretty bad, and we hope that doesn't happen.
And I guess that is the one of the great things about these sorts of skeptical prizes and challenges is that it diverts those types of people away from the scientific community. It kind of presents them with a glittering prize to stop them from, you know, getting involved in scientific research, of just presenting them with this public challenge that they can do that isn't.
Yeah, well, he's welcome. If he thinks that water divining works, he's welcome to come along. And being a scientist, he'd know full well how to construct a proper double blind test. We'd pay him the money. I mean, if he showed us. Now, when I say we have an open mind, we do. And when I say that we're appalled that anyone would spend any more time on water divining, I am, but there's that one bit of science that still says to me, if by some extraordinary way, after all these years and so many negative tests and a good explanation as to what's really going on, if that can be overturned, well, then so be it. But it would be disingenuous for me to say that we should waste any more, or anybody should waste any more money trying to prove it works when it so conclusively doesn't.
You talk a lot about people who've been mistaken or deluded or mentally ill. Do you come across people who are just frauds? They're just there because they want attention or they want the money, and they are deliberately trying to mislead both you and the general public about the skills that they have. Does that happen?
Yes, it does, yeah. It happens, but not often. It's another misconception, especially with the media and shows, tabloid TV shows and morning TV shows. They need to make things simple for their audience. So they'll paint somebody claiming to be a psychic as either they're amazing and they beat the skeptics and they've got this amazing power and they'll come on their shows and they'll do readings, or they'll paint them as the fraudster, the evil con shark who's out there ripping off poor innocent people who are grieving their lost family members, and they're cheating and everything like that. What they don't waste time acknowledging is that the most people, 90% of people who claim psychic ability really do think they have psychic ability, and they're nice people out to help. It's interesting. But yes, I have come across people, because I've studied cold reading, and I've seen endless people doing readings, as it were, in audience situations and this sort of thing. I know the signs, you know. I know the banter, I know the psychology, and I know when somebody is using routines, and I know when somebody is being genuine. And yes, I've seen people who I know are fakes. Some of them I've met know that I know that they're fakes, or frauds, I should say. But the next step is incredibly difficult because it involves all sorts of legal tangles. It's not like I can just now go on radio or TV and say, well, Mr. XYZ over there, he's a fraud. I would end up getting sued, and that's very tricky.
Is that part of the reason for you being so friendly and nice to the skeptics? To the psychics and the people making the claims that you come across, regardless of their beliefs? Or you're just a genuinely nice person?
It just makes life easier. It really does. But sometimes I'm not. I mean, don't get me wrong. Sometimes, especially when I go to what they call mind-body-spirit festivals, which we call mind-body-wallet, sometimes I let them have it. If I see someone doing something particularly dangerous when it comes to health, for example, peddling nonsense and giving people bad health advice and saying this magic machine will diagnose their heart problems, sometimes I can't help myself. But generally speaking, and that's difficult because it might make me feel better at the time, but it really doesn't solve anything. So generally speaking, I don't do that. I try not to do that.
If most people genuinely believe that they have these abilities, and if they want money, $100,000, $1 million, why aren't these tests completely overrun? why aren't there just thousands upon thousands of people coming and trying to claim the money every day? Because, I mean, there must be tens of thousands of people claiming or believing that they have some sort of psychic power just in Australia alone. And yet you can't be, I mean, inundated with people wanting to claim the money. Like, what do you think is stopping those people who don't, who believe they have powers, know about the test, but don't put up their hand for it? What do you think is stopping them?
That's a good question. We really don't know us. We should have a special office just to handle all the people lining up to take the money. A lot of people know about the tests, but assume that we're fakes, assume that we're going to rig it so they cannot win.
Yeah.
That belief is very strong. A lot of people I meet will do that, number on us, saying that you're skeptics, therefore you don't want to believe this is real, therefore the test can't be real. That accounts for a lot of people not applying, actually, because they've been told within their own community that these tests are fake. Partly, too, because since nobody has ever passed the Australian Skeptics Test or the James Randi Test or other tests around the world, there will be a feeling out there that these tests must be rigged. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And I can understand that. If you're a genuine believer in your psychic abilities and you discover that there's a test out there for $1 million but nobody has ever passed, despite lots of psychics applying, and you think, well, it must be rigged because otherwise it would have been won years and years and years ago. I think that accounts for a lot, yeah. But we do get people, you know, don't get me wrong, we do get people. But like I say, a lot of people can't answer the first question. And sometimes we get to the stage where we go through a test, but that can be a very long process simply because we are at pains to make it fair and we are at pains to make a test with their input and agreement and approval that they will pass if they have their claimed abilities. We will never, as long as I'm concerned, as you know, if I'm part of it, we would never ever construct a test which would be designed for somebody with real powers to fail. That would be a waste of my time, and I wouldn't be part of it.
And that's something that I think the psychics, I guess, or people who claim psychic abilities will always have over the skeptics, is that the skeptics are beholden to the cold rationality of the scientific method, whereas the psychics have a community and they have you know, people to support them in their beliefs, regardless of whether they're true or not, and they can build up these social networks. Whereas, I mean, obviously there is the Australian Skeptics, and people can join and go to the convention, and meetings, and have a great time. But you don't have that same level of emotional support and enablement that the skeptics that psychics and mediums have.
Possibly. I mean, we do have a huge social interaction online, especially in Skeptics in the Pub, which are all, it's all around the world, Skeptics in the Pub. There's one in Sydney, it's every month, and we have a great time. We have a guest speaker every month on any scientific topic, not always skepticism, and it's a big laugh. So there is a lot of social contact within the skeptical community, that's for sure.
But none of that contact is there to assist skeptics in believing something which is wrong. Like, at the end of the day, they're still beholden to this, the idea of scientific proof and rationality. And
I guess you're right. But also, there's a lot of bitterness and resentment and infighting in the psychic community. Don't think second they all love each other and get on. And I can't back this up with proof, folks, so don't jump on me now for looking like I'm putting the other side down. But in conversations I've had, because I've met many psychics along the way, they sometimes regard their fellow psychics as being either frauds or delusional too. So that's quite interesting. But then again, yes, a lot of them are very friendly with each other and they can rely on each other for support.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of an American magician who I won't name, who spent about 30 years working as a magician, and he had some success, not a great deal of success, but he had some success working in the magic community. And then, because when Derren Brown and a few other these mentalists became quite popular, he switched to mentalism and found that he had a lot of psychics and mediums coming to his shows and believing that he had real powers. And even though he had this 30 years of experience of knowing all of the ways in which these sort of these things can be faked, and the way in which, you know, cold reading works and all of the sleight of hand and psychological trickery required to fake psychic powers, he still began to believe that he really had some sort of power, and so now presents himself as a psychic. And I can't tell whether he truly believes he has psychic powers or if he is a con artist and a fraud. But I do see this community of people supporting him in a way that the magic community would never support him in him getting out and present, you know, him telling him that he has a beautiful gift and he is a wonderful man. Yeah. And so I don't know what to make of it. I don't know whether, you know, is he a con artist? Is he delusional? Or has he just purely by coincidence developed these extraordinary abilities after years as a magician?
Now, we were talking about before, most of the people that I've certainly encountered are true believers. It's very seductive. It's very seductive once you think you have a special power, and people feed off that and tell you you've got a special power, and you gain a certain reputation and you get notoriety and you're seen as someone special. That's amazingly seductive. And it can change the way you think without going into details. That's an interesting case. Yeah.
So what is next for these tests? Because they've existed for 50 years in various forms, or we go back to 1922, the Scientific American, you know, even longer, and they seem to sort of trundle along, and each, you know, the rules maybe change slightly, and the money sits in the bank and collects interest, and no one seems to make any money. And no one, it never seems to go any further. Are you happy for them just to sort of continue the way that they are? Or do you think that there's some new direction that these types of tests can go into the future?
The one in Australia is staying much the same it has for years and years and years. We have $100,000, and if you have a psychic or paranormal claim, which you can demonstrate to mutually the mutual satisfaction of yourself and us and an independent observer, then you get the money, end of story. The James Randi Educational Foundation is recently undergoing changes to the $1 million challenge, because it was simply realized that after 50 years of Randi offering various amounts of money, and it's been $1 million now for quite a lot of years, that it was just becoming pointless to spend time and effort to answer endless queries about it. And it's a lot of effort to set up even meetings to somebody who wants to claim it. And then every time, without fail, people fail the test. It's been decided to alter the $1 million challenge, whereas before it was open to all comers, it's more the James Randi Educational Foundation offering it to individuals or organizations. That's a bit of flux at the moment, but we're, from the James Randi Educational point of view, we're still happy for other people to offer the money to all comers. And indeed, if somebody were to pass the Australian Skeptics $100,000, I think the James Randi Educational Foundation would waste no time in offering the $1 million after that. But it serves two purposes, really. One is to hopefully find somebody who has special magical abilities beyond what we know as science, and then therefore improve our knowledge of science. And it's also to offer it to people who we think are maybe not on the level, and to publicize the fact that they've been offered the money, and to see where that goes.
Based on all of the tests that you've seen and all of the people, and those who've been fraudulent and those who've been true believers in their abilities, if someone was to turn around tomorrow and come in, walk into the to the Australian Skeptics Office and say, this is my skill, and perform it with 100% certainty, what skill do you think it would be? What paranormal ability do you think is the one that is most likely to win the prize? Like, what's the one that you feel like could? I'm not saying, I realize this makes it sound like if you turn around and say, it's palm reading. Of course, it's palm reading. That you'll somehow be giving some sort of endorsement into palm reading.
Yeah,
Is water, because to me, I think water divining. I feel like water divining is the one that doesn't require any knowledge in the existence of ghosts, and it's simple. It feels like it's easy to prove or disprove. That would be what I'd put my money on, is water divining.
I would have to say it's all comers, all level. Every claim when it comes to the paranormal, the supernatural, to my point of view, has an equal chance of being correct. So I could not pick one over the other. I've never thought about it in that way before, but to me, since every conceivable paranormal claim has not born through in tests, I can't imagine one being better able to win our money than another. But if one did, then so be it.
That's very diplomatic of you.
Well, no, I honestly can't. I mean, even if I were to say, oh yeah, I think tarot cards, but I don't.
Tarot cards? Come on, tarot cards? No.
Well, ask the tarot card reader. They'll tell you with incredible passion and certainty that it absolutely works. So there you go.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I leave you with one last question. This is my big philosophical question for you. Do you think that things of paranormal, of spiritual, or even religious, the religious realm, are beyond the reach of science? So this is an argument that you sometimes hear, the idea that it's not the role of science to prove or disprove spiritual matters because they are beyond science, in the same way as you don't use science to prove moral issues. You don't need science to prove or disprove issues of spirituality because they exist outside of the material world and universe. If science, the role of science is to measure the material world, material results in a material world, and we're talking about spiritual results in a spiritual world. Is it the job of science to try and prove or disprove these things? Surely they belong in a realm that is beyond the reach of science.
It's up to the person making the claim to prove it. And a lot of these claims to do with spiritual matters are testable. People say that a ghost can move an object on a table. You can test that. I guess you can test to see where the object moves mysteriously, but if people say they talk to ghosts and get meaningful information from them, there are ways to test that, to see if that is actually the case. And if you say there are worlds beyond the spiritual realm, whatever that may mean, well, is it there or is it not? We'll show it's there, and then we can proceed from there. It's a bit of a rambling answer, I think, but a lot of the claims we get to do with the paranormal are testable. You can test to see whether a water diviner can find water. You can test to see whether a tarot card reader can tell a lot about somebody that only through the tarot deck. You can test to see whether a clairvoyant can send telepathic messages to somebody. So in that respect, it's absolutely the role of science to look in and investigate these things.
Wonderful. To be fair, it was a fairly rambling question, so I think a rambling answer is entirely appropriate. Oh, thank you very much for being on Scammapalooza. If people want to find out more about the skeptics, the Australian skeptics, and the challenge, that's skeptics.com.au. You have your own podcast, which has been around for so many years. I didn't realize it had been so many. It had been around for so long. You're up to 347 episodes, something?
380 this
380.
Week.
380,
something like that. Yeah, it's been, I think the first episode aired in 2008, and it's been weekly ever since that. That's called The Skeptic Zone, skepticzone.tv, and that is 45 minutes to an hour every week of interviews and news and opinions from around the world in the skeptical and science spheres.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.